were here last night? How many of you did I put to sleep last night? Hey, I did all right. I didn't get one single hand on that one. Now, we have, a really profitable class tonight. We're going to be talking about... Hello? Oh, I guess I'll turn my mic on. Testing. All right, thank you. I appreciate that. Let me ask that question again. How many did I put to sleep last night? We're going to be dealing with predictive prophecies of the Bible, and I'm going to try real hard to get through this. They say that the average, or what they allot for a class is about 45 minutes, is about what I have. I question whether or not most people can get through this material in 45 minutes, but I'm going to do my best because I don't want to leave one single point out if at all possible tonight. I had to last night. This is some important information. I'm going to go ahead and get Ryan to queue up the first of the videos. We do have several of those that we're going to go through. And that's really what makes this one a bit more difficult to do because some of them are fairly long. So if we can go ahead and do fortune tellers.
Whether we're reading a book series, watching a television show, or anticipating a sporting event, one of the common tendencies of human beings is that we want to know what's going to happen next. Millions of people are fascinated by YouTube videos that make predictions about award ceremonies, political elections, and social and cultural trends. Anxious and curious men and women all over the world want to know about their future spouse, their future career, or other unknowable pieces of information that simply aren't available to us. This desire, which has likely been around for a very long time, has led to the rise of false prophets, mystics, psychics, palm readers, and a host of other charlatans who claim to be able to predict the future. We generally call this group of people fortune tellers. And this business can take a variety of forms. Some use the stars for their predictions. Others cast lots, bones, or stones. Some claim to be able to predict a person's future by reading the moles and scars or other on their body, which just sounds gross. Some interpret dreams, some gaze into fire, some use a Ouija board, and some read cards. According to a recent article, one of the primary psychological factors driving our fascination with fortune-telling is the need for certainty and control. Humans have an inherent desire to understand and predict the world around them. And by offering a glimpse into the future, fortune tellers provide a sense of certainty in an otherwise unpredictable world. This feeling of control over our lives can be comforting, reducing anxiety and providing a sense of direction. The article continues by saying that for many individuals, the future is an intimidating and uncertain concept. By consulting a fortune teller, they hope to gain insight and guidance, allowing them to make more informed decisions and prepare for potential challenges. Unfortunately for these people, they're putting their trust, along with large sums of money, into the hands of people who do not have the ability to do what they claim to be able to do. Anyone who could actually predict the future would be internationally famous, influential, and rich beyond their wildest dreams. Their fame and ability would be undeniable. Those people do not exist. Does this mean that no one has ever accurately predicted the future in ways that were observable, verifiable, and undeniable? Well, as you're about to find out, the Bible shows an objectively remarkable foreknowledge of things that human beings discover for thousands of years. Fortune tellers fake. The Bible, however, is very real.
Well, we have technical difficulties, as they say in the television industry when they have problems like that. But I think we got the gist of what he was getting at. we're forever hearing about people who claim that they can predict the future. Most of us have at least heard of Nostradamus, supposedly been able to predict from many, many years back. So often when they do that, one of the things that you notice is they give you such a broad answer to what the future is, they can make it fit somewhere down the line somehow. But one of the things that he did mention in here that I thought was interesting, when we're talking about the fortune-telling thing, people have relied on things like palm reading and they have cards. And while I certainly wouldn't waste my money on that, I'd be curious that if you went to one palm reader or one person who reads cards, supposedly they'll tell your future, and then picked up from there and went to another one, you know, on the other side of town or something like that, how much of a different answer you get each time? Because they can't. They can't answer, they can't tell you what your future's going to be like. But he also mentioned something that's very interesting to me, and that it is a booming business. Some of these numbers might surprise you. Listen to some of this. These were according to 1922 statistics, okay? Let's see if I can get to that one. That's not what I'm looking for. There we go. Oops, back it up. There you go. According to what's called Glassdoor.com, psychics made an annual salary of between $62,000 and $116,000. That's a pretty good income from somebody who is more than willing to lie to you. That's not bad. According to payscale.com, the hourly rate of a psychic is about $97 an hour. That's pretty good, too. I don't think I've ever made that much an hour. Well, let me back up. I know I've never made that much per hour. That's a pretty staggering amount of money. And while it can be difficult to obtain precise data and numbers and stuff like this, the fortune-telling industry in the United States is estimated to be worth, are you ready for this? $2 billion annually. That's pretty good industry, if you want to call it an industry. That's a lot of money. $2 billion a year. And again, for something that they have no ability to really do. They cannot read your palm and tell you anything about it. They cannot pick up a deck of their cards and lay them out there and tell you anything about your future at all. Now, what we do want to do is we want to take a look at some of a few examples tonight. We'll try to get these as quickly as we can. But I also will tell you this. Like last night, I do want to use these videos, and I hope the next one works a little bit smoother. I hope that thumb drive is not completely malfunctioning now. But we want to look at one that is the fall of Tyre. And that's an interesting one that I was unaware of. I hadn't thought too much about, I guess, in the past. But we do want to go ahead. Can I advance it to the video, or you have to? Okay. If you'll go to the video.
Most everyone understands that if there is a person or a book that can accurately predict the future, then that's superhuman. It just is something that no human by their own design or by their own skill can do. In fact, as we look into the Bible, we see that statement put forth to us. God himself said, "Let them bring forth and show us what will happen, or declare to us things to come. Show the things that are to come hereafter, that we may know you are gods." For years, in ancient cultures, people understood that if a person, if a prophet, if a book accurately predicts things that happen in detail in the future, and is never wrong about any of those, then that person, prophet, book has to have some type of divine origin. When we look into the Bible, we see that it's filled with prophecy. One of those very powerful prophecies that is evidence for the divine inspiration is the prophecy of Ezekiel found in chapter 26 concerning the city of Tyre. You see, Tyre was a city that came to prominence in about 1200 BC. It was one of the best natural ports on the Mediterranean Sea. It stood at the crossroads of worldwide trading. But the problem with Tyre was that it had become very wicked. During Ezekiel's day, he wrote that by the abundance of your trading, you became filled with violence within, and you sinned. Your heart was lifted up because of your beauty. You corrupted your wisdom for the sake of splendor. You defiled your sanctuaries by the multitude of your iniquities. You find that in Ezekiel chapter 28, verses 16 through 18. So Ezekiel says, because of the evil and wickedness that is within your walls, God is going to destroy you. And in Ezekiel chapter 26, he lists several things that were going to happen to the city of Tyre. He said that Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, would destroy the mainland villages. He said that Nebuchadnezzar would build a siege mound against the city. Ezekiel prophesied that many nations would come up against Tyre, that the city would be flattened like the top of a rock, and that its stones and its timber and soil would be laid in the sea, and it would become a place where men spread nets, and the city of Tyre would never be rebuilt. After Ezekiel's prophecy, Nebuchadnezzar did indeed besiege the city. In fact, it was a long siege of about 14 years. And in that time, the Tyrians, the inhabitants of Tyre, began to take all of their materials and move them out to an island about 3/4 of a mile off of the mainland. Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar eventually breached the city, and he got in to find that the Tyrians had all moved out. Yes, he did destroy the mainland villages, and he encamped around the city, built a siege mound against it. After Nebuchadnezzar did that, there were several scores and decades of years that other nations came up against the city of Tyre, until about 330 BC. In 330 BC, a man by the name of Alexander the Great was sweeping across the globe, conquering everything in his path. In fact, it's said that at one point in his life, he knelt and cried because there was no more world left to conquer. Alexander the Great came up against the mainland city of Tyre, as Ezekiel had predicted about those other nations. And he basically did the exact same thing that Nebuchadnezzar had done hundreds of years earlier, except after his siege, which wasn't nearly as long, only about 9 months, when he got into the mainland city, those Tyrians had moved to the island city. Now, Alexander the Great was not easily thwarted, and he did not do what Nebuchadnezzar did. Nebuchadnezzar basically said, "Oh, well," and he left. Alexander the Great said, "No, no one makes a fool of me." And so he started to devise plans as to how to get to the island city of Tyre. And how did he do that? Well, here's what he did. He decided he was going to take every single stone, piece of wood, and all the dirt from the mainland city of Tyre and was going to dump it into the Mediterranean Sea and build a land bridge out to the island city of Tyre. And that's exactly what he did. Took every bit of building material, scraped Tyre clean like a rock, and dumped it into the Mediterranean Sea. The prophecy that Ezekiel had uttered several hundred years before Alexander the Great ever stepped onto the scene came true when all of that building material was thrown down into the Mediterranean Sea. In fact, when Ezekiel said that the city would never again be rebuilt, oh, there's a city now that's in the relative same place as Tyre once was. It's also named Tyre. But the interesting thing about that, when that soil and timber and those stones were poured into the Mediterranean Sea, it caused the sand to build up there around the mainland, and the area where the original city once was, well, we don't even know where that is today exactly. The city can never be rebuilt because we can't even locate the exact point there on the edge of the mainland where the city once was. Ezekiel looked several hundred years into the future and talked about Tyre being scraped clean like a rock. In all of the annals of human history, how many cities have been scraped clean like that? Very, very few. And yet Ezekiel predicted it perfectly. How? Tell them to show us what will come in the future, what will be hereafter, and we will believe that they are gods. You see, that was the challenge God gave to the idols, but they couldn't. But God took up the challenge himself, and through the prophet Ezekiel, he told the world exactly what would happen to Tyre, and it came to pass. What can we uncover and discover from this truth? That the Bible is the product of God.
Okay, what I thought was also interesting, he was talking about some 300 years prior to Tyre being scraped like flat on the rock, nothing left, is that it was done talking about somebody that would do that had not been even born yet. Alexander the Great wasn't around. He couldn't have lived that long. So it's an amazing thing how the Bible repeatedly gives us that kind of information. It repeatedly helps us with predictive prophecy that no mere human being could foresee. We have another one, and this doesn't have a video, so I'm just going to go through it fairly quickly. And you'll notice here that they've done some play on words, like the previous one was flat tire. This one is dry me a river instead of cry me a river. So I don't know why they were doing that, but it does have interesting material in it. It says that Babylon was one of the richest cities in the entire world during the years of about 740 B.C. to about 680 B.C. So a pretty good run that they were considered one of the richest places in the world. Now, with that being said, during these days, let me see. Okay. Not going to worry about that one. Let's move to the next. Okay. Babylon gained its reputation because of its high and massive walls. It was a powerful city. It was one that was not going to be breached easily. In fact, it says ancient writers describe the walls that were, 14 miles long on all four sides of the city, reached heights of over 300 feet, and in some places the wall was 75 feet thick. Not an easily breached city wall. But the wall was definitely not the only form of defense. The Euphrates River surrounded the city, making a perfect moat that ranged anywhere between 65 and 250 feet across. Now, this wall or moat combination appeared to make the city unconquerable. Yet, in spite of the strong military defensive strength of the city, God's prophet actually foretold of its destruction, actually told that it was going to happen. Notice what it says in Jeremiah chapter 15, verse 9. It says, "Raise and cause to come up against Babylon an assembly of great nations from the north country." That's Jeremiah chapter 50 and verse 9. Now, this prediction probably seemed a little bit unfounded at the time. Probably didn't sound like it was even feasible, because none of the countries in the north came close to having enough power, enough strength to actually defeat Babylon. Remember, they were the strongest nation in the world at the time. But years after the prophecy, Cyrus, king of the Medo-Persian Empire, and we'll talk more about the Medo-Persian Empire in a little bit, but mounted a huge force of many different nations and marched southward against Babylon. So it wasn't going to be just this one particular nation, because remember, that it said that God would raise up and cause to come up against Babylon an assembly of great nations, Jeremiah 50 and verse 9. So there was going to be an assembly of them. It was an allied force, so to speak. And of course, the details of the fulfillment are amazing. Jeremiah recorded that God had declared, "I will dry up her sea and make her springs dry." Well, what happened? Well, a drought is against her water, it says. And they will be dried up, for it is the land carved images. It's a land of carved images. We'll get to that one, okay. Now, let's take a look at the story very quickly. The Euphrates River ran underneath the great walls of Babylon. After a siege of 2 full years, Cyrus diverted the river to make it flow into a huge marsh on the western side of the city. And by doing this, he dried up the rivers of Babylon and provided an easy way for his soldiers to enter under the city where the river used to go. The Babylonian Empire, the Babylonians inside the city had no idea what was taking place. They could have defended the city, but instead they were feasting and getting drunk. Cyrus ordered his men to act like drunken partygoers, in other words, to blend in, and by the time the Babylonians knew what had hit them, the city was filled with enemy troops who ultimately conquered it. Now, even though the above circumstances would be enough to prove the accuracy of the prophecy of Jeremiah, and thus the Bible, the prophet's predictions do not stop there. Chapters 50 and 51 of Jeremiah's book are filled with more futuristic condemnation of Babylon, all of which were fulfilled in the smallest of details. Well, let's see if I want to go through that much of it right now. We have some others that are going to take a lot longer. Let's skip on that's the gist of that one right there. Let's go to we'll move down the line here. There we go. There's where I want to be. Okay, we'll talk about the prophecy of Daniel chapter 8. But before we do that, we do have a video on this one as well. But before we do this, because I want to make sure that we get this in time, we have a prophecy before Daniel chapter 8 that I think is really interesting and is actually something that would foretell of the coming kingdom known as the church. We find that in Daniel chapter 2. Daniel chapter 2. If you remember the circumstances, in the second year of King Nebuchadnezzar's reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. I mean, chapter 2 and verse 1, and his spirit was so troubled that his sleep left him. Well, what did he do? Well, he went to his fortune tellers, what we might think in terms of his mystics in there, and these all these. Then the Chaldeans who he went to, talked to the king in Aramaic. He said, "O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and then we'll give the interpretation." But Nebuchadnezzar was not having any of that. He said, "No, I want to know what the dream was, and then give me an interpretation." You see, he was wise enough to understand, sharp enough to understand that what he did, if he told them the dream, if he told them the dream, well, guess what they would do? They'd make something up, and it couldn't be trusted. But now, if you can tell me the dream, then give me an interpretation of it, I know that what you're telling me is true. I know that the interpretation is going to be true. Well, guess what they couldn't do? It was impossible. But there was a man in captivity by the name of Daniel. In verse 13, by the way, notice verse 12, "For this reason," because they couldn't do it, "for this reason the king was angry and very furious and gave the commandment to destroy all the wise men of Babylon." Verse 13 says, so the decree went out and they began killing the wise men, and they sought Daniel and his companions to kill them, because they would have been fitting into that category. Then the counsel of the wisdom and wisdom of Daniel answered Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, who had gone out to kill the wise men of Babylon. And he answered and said to Arioch, the king's captain, why is the decree from the king so urgent? And then Arioch made the decision known to Daniel, told him what the circumstances were. And so Daniel went in and asked the king to give him time that he might tell the king the dream. And this is one of the fantastic things that we learned here in this section of scripture. And we're not going to read all of this. But it says that Daniel went to his house, made the decision known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, that they may seek mercies from the God of heaven concerning this secret, so that Daniel and his companions might not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. And the secret was revealed to Daniel in the night vision. So Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Now we're going to tie that in here in just a moment to another verse further down the line. But I want us to notice something here as we get into this section of scripture, beginning verse 25 and going through at least through verse 28. Arioch quickly brought Daniel before the king and said thus to him, I have found a man of the captives of Judah who will make known to the king the interpretation. And the king answered and said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, are you able to make known to me the dream which I have seen in its interpretation? And Daniel answered in the presence of the king and said, the secret which the king has demanded, the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, the soothsayers cannot declare to the king. But now listen to what Daniel does. But there is a God in heaven. There is a God in heaven who reveals secrets, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. In these dreams that he was having, God was telling Nebuchadnezzar what was going to happen. Why? When he did that? Because when your head was upon your bed. See, Daniel gave God the credit. And when you stop and look at every one of these predictive prophecies, that's why I wanted to start this one here before we get into Daniel chapter 8. Every one of the predictive prophecies, everything that we see, and we're touching just the hem of the garment tonight. There are so many of them, we wouldn't begin to have time to talk about all of them. But the idea here is that without God, none of these things would have been possible. Not one single prophecy of man could have ever possibly taken care of what we see here, to have predicted what we're looking at here. And so Daniel's wise enough to say, there's a God in heaven who reveals these secrets. In essence, he's saying, I can't do it in and of myself. I don't have that capability, but God can. And then he proceeds to do that. Now, again, we don't have time to read all of this, but he does the interpretation, or he gives the dream. He tells Nebuchadnezzar what the dream is. He says, this is the dream, verse 36. Now we will tell the interpretation of it before the king. Now you've heard the dream. This is what you saw. And obviously that was correct. He goes on by saying in verse 37, you, O king, are king of kings, for the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, strength, and glory. And wherever the children of men dwell, or the beasts of the field and the birds of heaven, he has given them into your hand and has made you ruler over them all. You are, he begins to explain, the head of gold. You're the head of gold, Nebuchadnezzar. But there's going to be one who will rise after you, and then another kingdom inferior to yours. And then another, a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over all the earth. And the fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters everything, and like iron that crushes, that the kingdom will break in pieces and crush all others. He says, whereas you saw the feet and the toes, and partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, the kingdom shall be divided. yet the strength of the iron shall be in it, just as you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay. Now we're going to stop there and notice something here. When you look at this, you realize very quickly that he's talking about different ages, different kingdoms. What God gave Daniel to tell Nebuchadnezzar was something that was going to project all the way into the Roman Empire. That first one, that gold head, was Babylon. That's who Nebuchadnezzar was king over. The second one was the silver. That would be the Medo-Persian Empire. In fact, when you go over to Daniel chapter 5, let's look at Daniel chapter 5 very quickly, verses 28 through 31. Okay. Notice what it says here. Your kingdom has been divided and given to the Medes and Persians. Guess what? There was no way that on his own accord, own way of knowing, Daniel could not have possibly known that. It'd be given over to the Medes and Persians. Who would have thought that during the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, the most powerful nation in the world, Babylon? Who would have thought that it was going to go down? And yet every great nation will eventually go down. But notice also, it says, then Belshazzar gave the command, and they clothed Daniel with purple and put a chain of gold around his neck and made a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler of the kingdom, that every night Belshazzar, king of the Chaldeans, was slain, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. That's the silver. But there's another one down the line. You are going to have the bronze on this statue. The bronze was the Grecian Empire. Well, is there anything that we can look at? Is there anything that we can know that this actually came true? Well, did you know that in 331 B.C., that Alexander the Great, someone he had just talked about, Alexander the Great went in and conquered the Medo-Persian Empire. As the Grecian Empire was growing and just spreading all over the world, it was almost like an unstoppable force. In fact, there was a point in time that they began to run out of places to conquer, and it said that history says that Alexander the Great actually wept over that. He was so filled with power, so power hungry, that when there was nobody else to conquer, when he started spreading himself so thin and he had nobody left to conquer, it literally caused him to weep over it. He cried over that. But not before this happened. And then, of course, we know about the Roman Empire. And that empire is when the iron and clay, that would be when the kingdom of Christ would be established, the church. A kingdom that would never come to an end. And so I wanted to get that one in before we went to Daniel chapter 8. Now, we do have a video on that, and again, it's a little bit lengthy, and I apologize for that, but they do such a good job on it. I don't want to interject too much. I'd much rather let them do what they need to do.
In Bible times, many of the nations around Israel worshipped idols. They claimed that these idols had just as much power as the God of Israel. And the prophet Isaiah issued a challenge to the idols. He said, "Let them bring forth and show us what will happen, or declare to us the things to come. Show the things that are to come hereafter, that we may know you are gods." Isaiah's point was clear. If the idols could predict the future, that would prove they were real gods. If they couldn't, well, that would prove they were frauds. The ability to accurately predict the future and be 100% correct has always been recognized as proof of divine inspiration. In the biblical book of Daniel, we find one of the most amazing and accurate prophecies ever written. In Daniel chapter 8, we read about a vision the author had in the third year of King Belshazzar. Secular historical records show us that this date would be approximately 550 B.C. In the dream, Daniel saw a ram with two horns pushing west and north and south. And he was informed that the two horns were symbols for the empire of the Medes and the Persians. When we look at secular history, we see this documented, the rise of the Medo-Persian Empire. Furthermore, in Daniel's vision, the ram with two horns was savagely defeated by a raging male goat that came out of the west with a notable horn in the center of its head. Daniel was then told that this goat was the kingdom of Greece, and the large horn on its head was the first king. When we look into the secular historical record, we see that it corresponds precisely with this prediction. And we find that Alexander the Great, the first king of Greece, defeated the Medo-Persian Empire and grew very great, just exactly as Daniel had foreseen. This is all the more remarkable because Alexander the Great defeated the Medo-Persian Empire some 200 years after the book of Daniel was written. Well, as we continue to follow Daniel's vision, we discover that after Greece had become great, the large horn was broken, and in place of it, four notable ones came up. Daniel was informed that the first king of Greece would die, and four kingdoms would rise in place of the one kingdom of Greece. So, what does secular history tell us? Ancient historian Diodorus Siculus documented the division of the kingdom of Greece when he wrote, "When they had been brought into the council, they demanded that Cappadocia and Lycia be given to Cassander, Hellespontine Phrygia to Lysimachus, all Syria to Ptolemy, and Babylonia to Seleucus. The Greek Empire, breaking into four kingdoms, perfectly coincides with Daniel's writing." And as we continue to unravel this amazing, remarkable prophecy, we see that in Daniel's vision, a little horn came out of one of the four notable kingdoms, and it grew to be great. Does history record the life of a person who fits this little horn prophecy? It certainly does. Out of the Seleucid Empire arose a king named Antiochus Epiphanes IV. His reign began in about 175 B.C. It lasted until 164 B.C. It was characterized by tyranny and deceit and brutality, just exactly as Daniel's vision predicted. The little horn of Daniel's vision was predicted to be so enamored with his own importance that the text states he even exalted himself as high as the prince of the hosts and would magnify himself in his heart. When we compare this prediction with the historical record of Antiochus Epiphanes IV, it is striking the similarity and the remarkable coinciding of the facts. Coins that were minted during his reign show that he exalted himself to the position of deity. One coin has on it the phrase of King Antiochus, "God manifest, victory bearer." Another depicts Antiochus with the phrase, "God manifest." Oh, there can be no doubt that this king exalted himself as high as the prince of the host. Daniel's vision also predicted that the little horn would cause the daily sacrifice in the temple in Jerusalem to cease. It's a simple matter of history to identify the point in time when this sacrifice ceased. The book of 1 Maccabees documents that Antiochus Epiphanes IV plundered the temple, and he gave the command, quote, "to put a stop to burnt offerings and meal offering in the temple." And in 167 B.C., he desecrated the altar in the temple, which the 1 Maccabees writer refers to as the abomination of desolation. In addition, this king would be broken without human means. When we compare the death of Antiochus Epiphanes IV with this statement, it matches perfectly. He didn't die in battle, nor was he assassinated by any conspirators. In fact, Antiochus Epiphanes did not die at the hands of any other human. Again, Roman historians from the secular record, Apion, from the 2nd century AD said he died of wasting disease. Diodorus Siculus recorded that he was driven mad and finally died of disease. The historical record proves that his death was not the result of any human means. Daniel was given a vision that stretched almost 400 years into the future and accurately predicted in precise detail the fate of nations. In fact, so accurate are Daniel's predictions that those who deny the inspiration of the Bible are at a serious loss. The skeptical community is forced to admit the book details events that took place long after 550 BC. Yet those who refuse to be convinced by the Bible's divine inspiration based on such accuracy, well, they're forced to say that the book of Daniel was written after the events it describes. Why do they say that? Because it's too accurate. The primary reason for denying the date of Daniel is that it contains information that no human in 550 BC could have known, which ironically is the very point that proves its divine inspiration. An honest look at the date of Daniel shows it was written in 550 BC. The accuracy of the prophecy is acknowledged even by many in the skeptical community. And this prophecy stands now, as it has for more than 2,500 years, and as it will until the Lord comes again, as a proof that the Bible is God's Word.
Okay, I know I've used a lot of the videos here, but again, I think I couldn't do any better than what they did on these videos explaining all these things. I had one more that we wanted to talk about. And yes, there is a video, but we simply don't have time for it. The video is over 7 minutes long. But it deals with Jesus prophesying about the fall of Jerusalem. Where do we find that? Matthew chapter 24. And interestingly enough, Jesus meticulously predicts the destruction of Jerusalem, an event that would take place about 40 years before it actually happened. Jesus actually told his disciples in Matthew chapter 24 and verse 2 that not one stone shall be left here upon another that shall not be thrown down. And his disciples were so surprised by that, they said, well, tell us when these things will be. And to answer the question, Jesus simply put it this way. He began to foretell of the destruction of Jerusalem. And false Christs and false prophets would rise up. We see that in Matthew chapter 24, 24 through 25. when we examine history between the periods of AD 30 and AD 70, we find a host of imposters that verify Jesus' prophecy. They came in and they claimed to be the Christ. They claimed to be deity. People like Theudas, Simon, an Egyptian who claimed to be the Son of God. And some of these names I'll probably mess up. Another one by the name of Dositheus also was one who claimed such things. We see from Matthew 24, 26 through 27 that the Roman historian would validate the wars and rumors of wars. When he wrote leading up to AD 70, I'm entering onto a city of a period which in disasters, frightful in its wars, torn by civil strife, even in peace full of horrors. Even when it was peaceful, it says full of horrors. Four emperors perished by the sword. There were three civil wars. There were more with foreign enemies, and were often wars that had both characters at once, both civil and foreign invaders. Talked about famines, pestilence, earthquakes. We find that in Matthew chapter 24 and verse 7. And I'm hurrying through it because we're about out of time. But Tacitus, also an historian, wrote, this year witnessed many prodigies. Houses were flattened by repeated earthquakes. Further portents were seen in shortages of corn, resulting in famine. And this was somebody who saw this period of time take place. He was actually there, and so he could verify the very things that Jesus had foreseen. And again, we're running out of time, but the very destruction of the temple, we talked about that. The days of vengeance that would take place. In fact, Jesus would even tell his listeners that during this time when this was taking place, that these were signs that the destruction of Jerusalem was coming. He said, you know, woe to those who are expecting, those women who are expecting children, that it should come during their time. He said, if you have something, don't go back into, when you see this taking place, don't go back into your house to get something. Flee to the mountains. Get out of there. So all these things were predicted so perfectly for the people to look at if they had just listened.